Okay, let us pray. Our Father in heaven, thank you for this class. Thank you for the rich heritage that we have in this country. And I pray you'll help us in studying it to benefit from it. Thank you for the news that our friends are coming home this week. I pray you'll bless their traveling and bring them here safely. In the name of Jesus, amen. Micah 6, 8, if you please. Micah 6, 8. And I'm having you turn to Micah 6, 8 because in the speech that we're going to start working on today, the president quoted this. Micah 6, 8. Ava, since you are on the left, would you please start our reading today, and please read us Micah 6, just verse 8.
He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God.
Amen. Okay, so you'll recognize that when we get to it. However, before that, the you know what, the quiz. Did your pen give up on you? Question number one is going to be multiple choice. I'm going to give three possible answers. Was Woodrow Wilson born 1826, 1856, or 1886? Was Woodrow Wilson born 1826, 1856, or 1886? Question number two will also be multiple choice in the same format. What year was Woodrow Wilson first elected president? 1902, 1912, or 1922? What year was Woodrow Wilson first elected president? 1902, 1912, or 1922? I hope you recognize that I am just asking essentially the same questions that I usually do, but since this is our second go-round on him, I thought third go-round on him, I thought I would give it be a little more specific. Number three, in what state did President Woodrow Wilson grow up? Mississippi, Georgia, or South Carolina? Not where he was born, but in what state did President Woodrow Wilson grow up? Mississippi, Georgia, or South Carolina? Hopefully I don't have the wrong two states mixed up again this week. I think I got it straight this time. Question number four. What is the name now of the university where Woodrow Wilson was a student and of which he was president? Question number five. Did President Wilson lead the U.S. to join World War I during his first term in office or his second term in office? And the bonus question. What was the first name of Woodrow Wilson's second wife who performed some of his duties after he had a stroke? What was the first name of Woodrow Wilson's second wife who performed some of his duties after he had a stroke? All right. Yeah, and you're not allowed to write Mrs. That is not
Mrs. Wilson.
Right. Did you know that I knew who my wife would be years before I ever met her? I knew my wife would be Mrs. Young. Do you know that same strange ability that I have? I also can tell the score of any baseball game before it ever even starts. 0-0. All right. little humor that I picked up going through school, and since you all are in a smaller kind of school, I thought maybe you hadn't heard some of those dumb school jokes and might need it. Okay, so what year was Woodrow Wilson born?
1856.
Uh-huh. What year was he first elected president? 1912. Mm-hmm. In what state did he grow up?
Georgia.
What state was he born?
Virginia.
Yes, I'm sorry I confused those last time. What is the name now of his university? Princeton.
Does that have an E or is it Prince?
Yes. Prince and then T-O-N, Princeton. And was it his first term or second term when we entered the war? His second term. Mm-hmm. And what was that wife's name?
Edith.
Ah, what was the last name?
Bowling.
Edith Bowling Wilson. Okay. All right then. Now, you might have got the word already by now that end of your program day, these two and I are going to be gone somewhere else. We can't come. So we are not going to be here to recite excerpts.
I don't even know if we're actually
So you two should get first choice of the of which ones you want to do. No, that's not so. Camilla and Estrella, having missed weeks of class, should probably get first choice of which ones they want to do. All right, then, what we'll do today is we'll let the person across from you choose your excerpt for you. Okay. Leva, which one do you want Ava to try?
Washington.
All right, Ava, let's hear Washington.
In 1783, George Washington, later to be the first president of the United States under our present Constitution, wrote to every state governor, "I now make it my earnest prayer that God would most graciously be pleased to dispose us all to do justice, to love mercy, and to demean ourselves with that charity, humility, and pacific temper of mind, which were the characteristics of the divine author of our blessed religion, and without an humble imitation of whose example in these things we can ever hope to be a happy nation."
That was just right, wasn't it? Congratulations. All right, then, Ava, you pick one for Lisa to try.
John Jay.
Okay.
In 1824, John Jay, former president of the Continental Congress, said, "By conveying the Bible to people, we enable them to learn that man was originally created in a state of happiness, but becoming disobedient, was subjected to the degradation which his posterity has since experienced, that our gracious Creator has provided for us a Redeemer, that this Redeemer has made atonement for the sins of the whole world, and thereby reconciling the divine justice with the divine mercy, has opened a way for our salvation, and that these inestimable benefits are the free gift and grace of God."
Woohoo! Look at this word with me. Degradation. And notice that the root grade in there. To degrade, to make it to go from one grade down to another. Degrade. I'm afraid that a G has got in there in your brain, and I think you're saying degradation.
Degradation.
Right. So understand the word grade in the middle of there and make that word degradation. Okay, Audrey, what would you like to hear Alvin say?
In 1805, Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, said, "I shall need the favor of that being in whose hands we are, who led our forefathers as Israel of old has covered our infancy with his prophet. No.
Who led Israel of old from
their native land and planted them in a country flowing with all the necessaries and comforts of life. Who has covered our infancy with his providence and our riper years with his wisdom and power. And to whose goodness I ask you to join with me in supplications.
That was quite good, despite the one little stalling out there. With one little prompt, you did say the entire thing correctly. So no standing ovation, but we do commend you for what you did. All right, which one would you like to hear Audrey say for us?
She didn't put both the short ones. 1805.
You just said
1813.
All right.
In 1813, John Adams, second president of the United States, wrote to Thomas Jefferson, "The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God."
Very nice. Thank you very much. Friends and neighbors, today we have, wherever I put him, today we have President Warren G. Harding. Warren G. Harding. Until getting ready for this class, I had never heard what the G stands for. I'd heard the name Warren G. Harding many times, but I'd never heard Gamaliel, that character in the New Testament, a famous Bible teacher who was Saul of Tarsus's teacher, he says. He grew up at the feet of Gamaliel. Warren Gamaliel Harding, 29th president. He was president from 1921 to 23. 1921 to 1923.
How do you spell the middle name?
Okay. 1865, born in Ohio. Born in Ohio, 1865. 1865 was the last year of the war between the states, Civil War. He was the oldest of eight children. So a rather a small family, I suppose, to you all. Oldest of eight children. His mother was a midwife. Isn't that interesting? In 1879, age 14, which is what Leva is about not to be and about what Ava is about to be, he started college at a college in Ohio. 1882, graduated college. So that's approximately what one of our friends from church did, right? Start college about that age, or younger maybe. Okay, after college, 1883, bought a failing newspaper in his hometown of Marion, Ohio. He bought a newspaper that was failing, and he worked at that newspaper and made it successful, and then the operation of that newspaper was his main business the rest of his life. He was not a lawyer. You know, we've had lawyer after lawyer as presidents, but he was not a lawyer. He was a journalist and businessman and publisher. Soon after starting in that newspaper business, 1884, he attended the Republican National Convention, the RNC, the Republican National Convention, which was just held, this year's was just held a couple of weeks ago. That was kind of his start in politics. Now, here is something that I don't have a date for. But Warren Harding was a Baptist. He was a Baptist church member most of his life. There in Marion, Ohio, he was a deacon in Trinity Baptist Church. The article I read said that he was the first president of the U.S. who was a Baptist. Not the last. There have been others, but he was the first. In 1891, he married a woman who had been divorced, a divorcee, Florence King. And he and Florence never had any children then. And the article I was reading mentioned that but didn't explain it. But they never had children. Not having any children, she became heavily involved in his newspaper business and his eventual political career, so that she was a very important supporter and partner both in business and in politics. Florence. A big part of his rise in politics was that in 1896, when William McKinley was running for president, Warren G. Harding traveled all over Ohio giving speeches in favor of William McKinley for president. In 1899 was when he was first actually elected to public office as an Ohio state senator. Not a senator from Ohio to the U.S. government, but a senator from his district in the state to their state legislature, state senate. 4 years later, 1903, he was elected lieutenant governor of Ohio. Lieutenant governor, kind of like vice president, but in some states, especially Texas, lieutenant governor has actual political, has actual governmental function. 1914, then, he was elected U.S. senator. You know how each state gets a certain number of senators, and what is that number?
Two.
Two. Each state, two senators. So he was elected senator from Ohio to the U.S. Senate. So then, living in Washington, D.C. most of the time, he became a member of Calvary Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. In the last year of his term as senator, he ran for president and was elected president in 1920. 1920, elected president. The person who is in the White House now stood for election in 2020. So we're talking about the president from 100 years ago. During his first term as president, 1923, in the winter, in January, he got the flu, or influenza, was very sick, and never got all the way better. This is early 1923. That summer, he had a big tour of the West planned to go visit and speak in the Western states. You know that in our lifetimes, since jet airplane travel has become common and the president can fly around wherever on that luxury airplane, Air Force One, it is now relatively common for the presidents to visit everywhere in America. But back then, when the fastest way of travel was by train and, you know, took several days to get anywhere, then this was a big deal for him to be going out west and visiting all the Western states and even visiting Alaska. That was planned, and although he wasn't very well, he still did it. And he did succeed in going and visiting Alaska, which was not yet a state then, but was U.S. territory. However, that summer, in August, he died, possibly of heart attack, age 57. I just turned 55, so just about how old I am. During his presidency, he was very popular, was very widely, highly esteemed, very widely held as a good president. Apparently, he had, one of the articles that I read said that he was quite affable. Yesterday, I was talking to Alvin, and Alvin mentioned the term personable. Not of him, but of somebody else. I believe that he was personable. He was very well liked, good at speaking in public and communicating well. He died a very popular president. However, after his death, various serious scandals in his administration came to light, and some of his officers even were prosecuted for crimes committed, and so his reputation was tarnished, and he is not now remembered as with as good of a reputation as he had during his lifetime. And correspondence, letters, have come into the public record that revealed behind the scenes moral failings, that he was living in some ways that are immoral, even while maintaining a good public image and going to church. So that's a sad postscript there to that brief history of Warren G. Harding. I have here for your consideration President Warren G. Harding's inaugural address. Pass that to your big brother, please. Pass that to your big sister, please. For you, it's two pages.
Same thing.
You did the same thing? I'm sorry, I should have explained. All right. Okay. Ava has read aloud already. Alvin, why don't you start? You notice that the paragraphs are short here, and we will probably find the language more accessible than we have. I think as we get closer and closer to ourselves, the way the presidents are speaking gets more and more familiar to us. So would each of you read one of these short paragraphs? And I do not promise, not to stop you and make comments as we go along. Okay?
When one surveys the world about him after the great storm, noting the marks of destruction, and yet rejoicing in the ruggedness of the things which withstood it, If he is an American, he breathes the clarified atmosphere with a strange mingling of regret and new hope.
He's not talking literally about a storm. He's using the figure of a storm to represent what? World War I, right? Which is not what they called it at the time. The Great War.
We have seen a world passion. We have seen a world passion spend its fury.
Maybe a typo or something. Maybe it's we have seen a world's passion, or the world's passion, or a world passionately, or something like that.
We have seen a world's passion spend its fury, but we contemplate our republic unshaken and hold our civilization secure. Liberty within the law, and civilization are inseparable. And though both were threatened, we find them now secure. And there comes to Americans the profound assurance that our representative government is the highest expression and surest guarantee of both.
Standing in this presence, mindful of the solemnity of mm-hmm. this occasion, feeling the emotions which no one may know until he senses the great weight of responsibility for himself, I must utter my belief in the divine inspiration of the founding fathers. Surely there must have been God's intent in making of this new world republic.
Ours is an organic law which had but one ambiguity, and we saw that effaced in a baptism of sacrifice and blood. All right, so he is saying that our Constitution, rising organically out of the self-evident truths that this nation knew, had just one thing in it that really wasn't as it should be, the provision for involuntary servitude, which now has been effaced, wiped out in a baptism of sacrifice and blood, namely the war, not referencing the Great War, World War I here, referencing the Civil War, or war between the states. With union maintained, the nation supreme and its concord inspiring, we have seen the world rivet its hopeful gaze on the great truths on which the founders wrought. We have seen civil, human, and religious liberty verified and glorified.
In the beginning of the old world...
Hold on. The old world. What's he referencing?
The world between... Before the war?
No.
Europe.
Mm-hmm. The countries of Europe. The old world, and then over in the Americas, the new world.
In the beginning, the old world scoffed at our experiment. Today, our foundations of political and social belief stand unshaken, a precious inheritance to ourselves, an inspiring example of freedom and civilization to all mankind. Let us express renewed and strengthened devotion in grateful reverence for the immortal beginning and utter our confidence in the supreme fulfillment.
The recorded progress of our republic, materially and spiritually, in itself proves the wisdom of the inherited policy of non-involvement in old world affairs. Confident of our ability to work out our own destiny and jealously guarding our right to do so, we seek no part in directing the destinies of the old world. We do not mean to be entangled. We will accept no responsibility except as our own conscience and judgment in each instance may determine.
Pause there, if you please. Is that what he just said? A policy of non-involvement in old world affairs, non-involvement in European matters. Is that in keeping with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, or against what Thomas Jefferson and George Washington said? In keeping with. Is it in keeping with the recent policies of Woodrow Wilson, or against? Against, yes. What he said right there is a very strong repudiation of the Wilsonian politics. Who, you know, his attitude was, we are going to go over there, we are going to direct their affairs, etc. Pray continue. The next person. Oh, I'm sorry, did I stop you in the middle of a paragraph or at the end of one? Okay, please continue, Miss Audrey.
Our eyes never will be blind to a developing menace. Our ears never deaf to the call of civilization. We recognize the new order in the world with the closer contacts which progress has wrought. We sense the call of the human heart for fellowship, fraternity, and cooperation. We crave friendship and harbor no hate. But America, our America, the America built on the foundation laid by the inspired fathers, can be a party to no permanent military alliance. It can enter into no political commitments, nor assume any economic obligations which will subject our decisions to any other than our own authority.
I am sure our own people will not misunderstand, nor will the world misconstrue.
Oh.
What does that
mean? It means to construe something means you have said something, and I have taken it to mean something. To misconstrue is for me to take what you said and kind of arrange it in my mind into something you didn't really mean. So we're trusting that since everybody knows what we're all about and we're stating it all plainly, and this is our historical tradition, we trust that the world will not misconstrue what I'm saying here.
We have no thought to impede the paths to closer relationship. We wish to promote understanding. We want to do our part in making offensive warfare so hateful that governments and peoples who resort to it must prove the righteousness of their cause or stand as outlaws before the bar of civilization.
We are ready to associate ourselves with the nations of the world, great and small, for conference, for council, to seek the expressed views of world opinion, to recommend a way to approximate disarmament and relieve the crushing burdens of military and naval establishments. We elect to participate in suggesting plans for mediation, conciliation, and arbitration, and would gladly join in that expressed conscience of progress which seeks to clarify and right the laws of international relationship and establish a world court for the disposition of such justifiable questions as nations are agreed to submit thereto.
In expressing aspirations, in seeking practical plans, in translating humanity's new concept of righteousness and justice and its hatred of war into recommended action, we are ready most heartily to unite. But every commitment must be made in the exercise of our national sovereignty.
Since freedom impelled and independence inspired, and nationality exalted, a world supergovernment is contrary to everything we cherish and can have no sanction by our republic. This is not selfishness, it is sanctity. It is not aloofness, it is security. It is not suspicion of others, it is a patriotic adherence to the things which made us what we are.
Today, better than ever, we know the aspirations of humankind and share them. We have come to a new realization of our place in the world and a new appraisal of our nation by the world. The unselfishness of these United States is a thing proven. Our devotion to peace for ourselves and for the world is well established. Our concern for preserved civilization has had its impassioned and heroic expression. There was no American failure to resist the attempted reversion of civilization. There shall be no failure today or tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
The success of our popular government rests wholly upon the correct interpretation of the deliberate, intelligent, dependable popular will of America. in the deliberate questioning of a suggested chance of national policy where internationally was to supersede nationally. We turned to a referendum. We turned to a referendum to the people, to the American people. There was ample discussion, and there is a public mandate in manifestation understanding.
So, if I understand what he's referring to here, it's, you know how Woodrow Wilson proposed the League of Nations as part of the Treaty of Versailles during the Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I, of the Great War. And Warren Harding was in the Senate, and he was from the other party, and he was one of the people identified with opposition to one of the articles in that treaty, which was the article that was going to make the U.S. automatically be at war with any country that attacked somebody else or something like that. And largely on that basis, the fact that U.S. sovereignty would in effect be surrendered, making us have to do something. If somebody does something else, then we have to do this. He and others opposed it. And then, him being well known as one of those people that opposed the League of Nations, he then ran for president. And the vote, and he won the election, referred to here as the referendum, he won election for president as somebody well known to have been against the Wilsonian League of Nations. And so he considers that the will of the people is now manifest. It's known. It's openly known. The will of America is not that we get into a thing like the League of Nations or some international arrangement where we're compelled to do something. Okay? It's my turn. America is ready. America is ready to encourage, eager to initiate, anxious to participate in any seemly program likely to lessen the probability of war and promote that brotherhood of mankind which must be God's highest conception of human relationship. Because we cherish ideals of justice and peace, because we appraise international comity and helpful relationship no less highly than any people of the world, we aspire to a high place in the moral leadership of civilization, and we hold a maintained America, the proven republic, the unshaken temple of representative democracy, to be not only an inspiration and example, but the highest agency of strengthening goodwill and promoting accord on both continents. A maintained America. He is saying that, yeah, we're for all of these good things, but our idea of how that's best maintained, how that is best accomplished, is to have America maintained as a solid republic. And that will be the best way for our country to work toward peace in other places. Not our active involvement in foreign affairs, but instead our maintaining our America as a solid republic. Pray continue.
Mankind needs a worldwide benediction of understanding. It is needed among individuals, among peoples, among governments, and it will inaugurate an era of good feeling to make the birth of a new order. In such understanding, men will strive confidently for the promotion of their better relationships, and nations will promote the comities so essential to peace.
We must understand that ties of trade bind nations in closest intimacy, and none may receive except as he gives. We have not strengthened ours in accordance with our resources or our genius, notably on our own continent, where a galaxy of republics reflects the glory of New World democracy. But in the new order of finance and trade, we mean to promote enlarged activities and seek expanded confidence.
Perhaps we can make no more helpful contribution by example than prove a republic's capacity to emerge from the wreckage of war. While the world's embittered travail did not leave us devastated lands or desolated cities, left no gaping wounds, no breath of hate, it did involve us in the delirium of expenditure, in expanded currency and credit, in unbalanced industry, in unspeakable waste and disturbed relationships. While it uncovered our portion of hateful selfishness at home, it also revealed the heart of America as sound and fearless, and beating in confidence unfailing.
Amid it all, we have riveted
mm-hmm.
the gaze of all civilization to the unselfishness and the righteousness of representative democracy, where our freedom never has made offensive warfare, never has sought territorial aggrandizement?
Yeah.
Territorial aggrandizement through force, never has turned to the arbitrament of arms until reason has been exhausted. When the governments of the earth shall have established a freedom like our own and shall have sanctioned the pursuit of peace as we have practiced it, I believe the last sorrow and the final sacrifice of international warfare will have been written.
Good. I don't know why the author put all the most difficult, obscure words in just that paragraph, but you sure got through it. Let me speak to the maimed and wounded soldiers who are present today, and through them convey to their comrades the gratitude of the Republic for their sacrifices in its defense. A generous country will never forget the services you rendered. And you may hope for a policy under government that will relieve any maimed successors from taking your places on another such occasion as this. Understand that he's recognizing that there were young men sent over the ocean to fight in a war far from our own country. And a lot of them came back, badly injured permanently. And he is assuring them, you have reason to hope that this government will not do that again. You have reason to hope in this government policy that there will not be, you will not have successors taking your place in the future. That there will not be another generation of young men who come back from war horribly injured. Now, that did not actually end up being the case, but that is the policy he is expressing here. If you please.
Our supreme task is the resumption?
Mm-hmm. The resuming.
Our supreme task is the resumption of our onward normal way. Reconstruction, readjustment, restoration, all these must follow. I would like to hasten them. If it will lighten the spirit and add to the resolution with which we take up the task, let me repeat for our nation, we shall give no people just cause to make war upon us. We hold no national prejudices. We entertain no spirit of revenge. We do not hate, we do not covet, we dream of no conquest, nor boast of armed prowess.
Strength or ability.
If, despite this attitude, war is again forced upon us, I earnestly hope a way may be found which will unify our individual and collective strength and consecrate all America, materially and spiritually, body and soul, to national defense.
I can vision the ideal republic, where every man and woman is called under the flag For assignment to duty, for whatever service, military or civic, the individual is best fitted. Where we may call to universal service every plant, agency, or facility, all in the sublime sacrifice for country, and not one penny of war profit shall inure the benefit of private individual, corporation, or combination, but all above the normal shall flow into the defense chest of the nation.
There is something inherently wrong, something out of accord with the ideals of representative democracy, when one portion of our citizenship turns its activities to private gain amid defensive war, while another is fighting, sacrificing, or dying for national preservation.
Out of such universal service will come a new unity of spirit and purpose, a new confidence and consecration, which would make our defense impregnable, our triumph assured. Then we should have little or no disorganization of our economic, industrial, and commercial systems at home, no staggering war debts, no swollen fortunes to flout the sacrifices of our soldiers, no excuse for sedition, no pitiable slackerism, no outrage of treason. Envy and jealousy would have no soil for their menacing development, and revolution would be without the passion which engenders it.
Next paragraph is a regret.
Yes.
A regret for the mistakes of yesterday must not, however, blind us to the tasks of today. War never left such an aftermath. There has been staggering loss of life and measureless wastage of materials. Nations are still groping for return to stable ways. Discouraging indebtedness confronts us like all the war-torn nations, and these obligations must be provided for. No civilization can survive
repudiation of a debt, meaning I have a debt to pay, but I'm not going to pay it. Saying that when a civilization in general, or a nation, or specifically that nation's government, incurs debts, if that government then says, but we're not going to pay it, he says that is extremely detrimental to your civilization.
We can reduce the abnormal expenditures, and we will. We can strike at war taxation, and we must. We must face the grim necessity with full knowledge that the task is to be solved, and we must proceed with a full realization that no statute enacted by man, can repeal the inexorable laws of nature.
Our most dangerous tendency is to expect too much of government, and at the same time to do for it too little. We contemplate the immediate task of putting our public household in order. We need a rigid and yet sane economy, combined with fiscal justice, and must be attended by individual prudence and thrift, which are so essential to this trying hour and reassuring for the future.
The business world reflects the disturbance of war's reaction. Here flows the lifeblood of material existence. The economic mechanism is intricate, and its parts interdependent, and has suffered the shocks and jars
incident
to a bomb.
Abnormal
demands, credit inflations, and price upheavals.
The normal balances have been impaired. The channels of distribution have been clogged. The relations of labor and management have been strained. We must seek the readjustment with care and courage, our people must give and take. Prices must reflect the receding fever of war activities. Perhaps we never shall know the old levels of wages again, because war invariably readjusts compensations, and the necessaries of life will show their inseparable relationship. But we must strive for normalcy to reach stability.
All the penalties will not be light nor evenly distributed. There is no way of making them so. There is no instant step from disorder to order. We must face a condition of grim reality, charge off our losses, and start afresh. It is the oldest lesson of civilization. I would like the government to do all it can to mitigate. Then, in understanding, in mutuality?
Yes, mutuality.
Of interest. In concern of the common good, our tasks will be solved. No altered system will work a miracle. Any wild experiment will only add to the confusion. Our best assurance lies in efficient administration of our proven system.
The forward course of the business cycle is unmistakable. People are turning from destruction to production. Industry has since changed order, and our own people are turning to resume their normal onward way. The call is for productive America to go on. I know that Congress and the administration will favor every wise government policy to aid the resumption and encourage continued progress.
I speak for administrative efficiency, for lightened tax burdens, for sound commercial practices, for adequate credit facilities, for sympathetic concern, for all agricultural problems, for the omission of unnecessary interference of government with business, for an end to government expenditure in business,
and not government's expenditure, but government's
government experiment mm-hmm. in business, and for more efficient business in government administration.
With all of this, must attend a mindfulness of the human side of all activities, so that social, industrial, and economic justice will be squared with the purpose of a righteous people.
With the nationwide induction of womanhood into our political life, we may count upon her intuitions, her refinements, her intelligence, and her influence to exalt the social order. We count upon her exercise of the full privileges and the performance of the duties of citizenship to speed the attainment of the highest state. Say, when was women's suffrage accomplished? Do you know?
I thought it was in the 1920s. But
I think that's what he's referring to. Now at this time now women are voting, but that's a recent development. If you please, miss.
I wish for an America no less alert in guarding against dangers from within than it is watchful against enemies from without. Our fundamental law recognizes no class, no group, no section. There must be none in legislation or administration. The supreme inspiration is the common weal. Humanity hungers for international peace, and we crave it with all mankind.
My most reverent prayer for America is for industrial peace, with its rewards widely and generally distributed amid the inspirations of equal opportunity. No one justly may deny the equality of opportunity which made us what we are. We have mistaken unpreparedness to embrace it to be a challenge of the reality, and due concern for making all citizens fit for participation will give added strength of citizenship and magnify our achievement.
Would you all skip, please? Turn the page over, because we're almost out of time. But let's go to near the end. And, Ms. Audrey, do you see the paragraph that says there is no shortcut? Would you all find that place? It's a few paragraphs up from the bottom. It says there is no shortcut. Please start reading there.
There is no shortcut to the making of these ideals into glad realities. The world has witnessed again and again the futility of the mischief and the mischief of ill-considered remedies for social and economic disorders. But we are mindful today, as never before, of the friction of modern industrialism, and we must learn its causes and reduce its evil consequences by sober and tested methods. Where genius has made for great possibilities, justice and happiness must be reflected in a greater common welfare.
Service is the supreme commitment of life. I would rejoice to acclaim the era of the golden rule and crown it with a
autocracy
of service. I pledge an administration wherein all the agencies of government are called to serve and ever promote an understanding of government purely as an expression of the popular will.
One cannot stand in this presence and be unmindful of the tremendous responsibility. The world upheaval has added heavily to our tasks, but with the realization comes the surge of high resolve, and there is reassurance in belief in the God-given destiny of our republic.
If I felt that there is to be sole responsibility in the executive for the America of tomorrow, I would shrink from the burden. But here are 100 millions, with common concern and shared responsibility, answerable to God and country. The Republic summons them to their duty, and I invite cooperation.
I accept my part with single-mindedness of purpose and humility of spirit, and implore the favor and guidance of God in His heaven. With these I am unafraid and confidently face the future.
I have taken the solemn oath of office on that passage of Holy Writ, wherein it is asked, "What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God?" This I plight to God and country.
All right. We are left with a couple minutes to discuss this. I welcome any of your comments. Would you like to tell your general impression or anything that struck you as particularly interesting?
You seem to be kind of advocating for the things that Wilson was advocating for, just saying we can accomplish them in a different way.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Peace among nations, a new order where it's not whoever can war the strongest, you know, but looking to high ideals to preserve peace, but in a different way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else would you all say about this, or what would you like to ask? Are you hearing in this what could be best described as progressive or conservative? Does he seem to be advocating let's do something new, or let's return to something old? Which of those would you say is more characteristic of what he's saying?
Return to something old.
Yeah. Let's maintain the long established and proven. Wilson's speech that we read was much more the let's try new things. Wilson's way of speaking was, the substance of what Wilson had to say was, we want the good of all mankind. Therefore, let's get the government in there and accomplish it until the government has made sure that mankind does have good. Harding is expressing something like, we want the good of all mankind. Therefore, let's restrict the government to its traditional necessary functions and have it be as efficient as possible so that mankind doing their duty can get all the good that they can get. Two distinctly different ways of pursuing the same end, ideally. Okay, that's it. Well, go ahead, Miss.
I like to see him advocating for what Washington was saying, don't make leagues with other nations.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the thing that we read in Washington's letter to the governors of Micah 6:8.
Right.
Justice, love, mercy, etc.
Because we looked at that, and if I recall correctly, we identified that he was closer to the Geneva Bible way of quoting that, but he was quoting the same. It wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility for Warren Harding or whoever was helping him write this speech to have reviewed the George Washington material, because it sure does sound some of the same notes, doesn't it? And exactly that same note. So just remember, this is not ancient history.